Good afternoon. I call this meeting of the House Finance and Policy Committee to order and welcome folks back. It's good to be back. It's good to see a lot of friendly faces, and there's some new faces as well. I'll note that there is a quorum present, and we'll take care of some housekeeping first. Vice Chair, have you had a chance to review the minutes?
Yes, I
have. All the way back from March 29th, 2023.
Yes, I have, Mr. Chair. Apparently that was a very busy day. So motion for approval of the minutes on March 29th, 2023.
Any discussion? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. All right, minutes are approved. Members, staff, and those in attendance, we're back in the saddle here in housing. We do have some new faces, and so first I want to take an opportunity to allow some of our new staff to introduce themselves, and I'll start to my left with Ms. Highmark.
Hello, everyone, Mr. Chair. Good afternoon. I'm Katrina Highmark. I'm the new fiscal analyst, replacing Kathy Schill, who retired on Friday. So it's great to be here. Thank you all. Looking forward to working with you all.
Some of our other new staff, I'll turn it over to Mr. Grundhauser.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair. I look forward to being a part of the committee this year and work on some housing issues. I've been with the House since 2019 and glad to finally make it in this sphere.
And then a new team housing on to my left and my right. I'll turn it over to Ms. Erdahl.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Emma Erdahl, and I've joined as the committee legislative assistant.
And Mr. Dockendorf.
Hi, Jack Dockendorf. I'll be the committee administrator this year. Looking forward to it. Thanks.
All right. Well, folks, we will have some presentations shortly, but I just want to do a little level setting for us as we begin the 2024 session here in the Housing Committee. And, you know, last year what we did was listen to Minnesotans and take bold action on the challenges they face to have what all of us really should want and deserve, an affordable, safe place to call home. And so what does that mean for this year? Well, it means doing a lot of the same things. It means listening to Minnesotans, understanding the challenges in their face, and bringing forward solutions that meet the needs across the state. And I know we all had a good chance to take some time off, hopefully spend time with family. I sure know I did. I also spent some time touring the state, talking with folks about housing, about the legislation we passed last year, and gaining perspective. And one thing that was clear to me, the challenges folks are facing are real. They're raw. They're singular. The ability to have a home that folks can afford is still challenging Minnesotans, and I think we'll hear presentations that show how big that job is in front of us. But we also know that we took bold action that's going to make a big difference. And so we look forward today and this term to hear about the good work that's being implemented based on the legislation we passed last year, the impact it's having, and this committee will stay focused on that implementation to make sure we get it right, to make sure that we are having the desired impact for the tens of thousands of Minnesotans that will benefit from our bold housing bill that takes action to prevent homelessness all the way to create pathways to home ownership. Still, we know that there are fundamental challenges to our housing ecosystem here in Minnesota. And I'll just say it, we can approve $1 billion in housing, which we can and should, but it's not going to be fully maximized unless we address some of the underlying barriers that are preventing access to an affordable home, that are preventing our ability to build more homes. We have more work to do, and that is going to be the work of the committee this session. So with that, I'll just say welcome back, and let's get to work. Up next, let's see here. I'm a little out of practice. We will go to our first presentation and welcome Commissioner Ho to present on some of that. You know, we had an interim, but Commissioner Ho has been quite busy after we asked the state agency to implement a historic housing bill. And I see I'm going to turn to Lee Johnson as well.
Chair Howard. We spent a lot of money last year, almost $1.4 billion with the budget that we passed. the tough part is it didn't help any of the issues. It helped some with the rental, building a lot of rental units across the state. But it's missing a very important part, and I'm hoping that we can focus on that this year. That would be the lack of starter homes. We, in Minnesota, we're about 110,000 homes short of where we need to be. And for people to get started, they need that starter home. Unfortunately, a lot of developers across the state, and a lot of cities, they want that $500,000 to $600,000 home so they have their tax base. The problem with that is most people can't afford that as their starter home. Where if they have an opportunity to get that starter home, they get their equity, and it's and generally a home is their largest investment. But they get that equity with that starter home so they can move on to a larger home, having that equity towards getting that larger house for their family. But I consider a starter home the bookend, because it's what you start with. But when the family leaves and it's just down to the probably grandma and grandpa at the time, they don't need that large house, and they're looking for a smaller home. And they want to keep as much equity as they can for later on when they have to maybe move somewhere else, whether it's assisted living or just into a senior housing development. But there is, and that's the same style house that they need as the starter home, the smaller home. So I'm hoping this year we can work on that, find ways to encourage cities to do the starter home developments. Because when they get the starter home developments, they get people moving into their city and their population grows and their city grows. And if they get that population growth, commercial and industrial will follow, increasing that tax base. But the biggest barrier that these small cities have is the infrastructure, the water and sewer to put in the development to keep those costs down so those starter homes can be affordable. So I'm hoping that this year we can work on something like that, because it's so important and it's a big decision for these people to make to get that starter home so they can build their generational wealth that they can pass on to their kids and their grandkids.
Thanks, Lee Johnson. I am very optimistic. There's a lot of bipartisan work we can do beginning as soon as next week on those exact issues. Commissioner Ho, welcome.
Chair Howard and members of the committee, my name is Jennifer Ho, and I am the Commissioner of Minnesota Housing. I am here with Dan Kitzberger, my legislative director, and Amanda Wellover, who you also see with us at the Capitol this year. It is really great to be back with you, and I'm really excited about session. I just want to start, if I may, I just want to send a verbal Valentine to each and every one of you, to your staff, to our colleagues in the audience, and all the partners. I know I was going to do that, but it's like a little much. All our partners across the great state of Minnesota, from preventing and ending homelessness to creating more first-time home buyers, it is all done through partnership. I want to thank the chair for allowing me to start this session by reminding us where we left off last May and to report on what has transpired since. 2023 was a big year for Minnesota housing. Thank you. I want to show you these bar graphs first. What it shows is the dark blue that you can barely see was the base funding that we came into session with. And the green bar next to it is the funding that was authorized here. And showing it across the different major activities that the agency does. And then over on the pie chart, you can just see the distribution across those major activities: capital resources, housing stability, homeownership assistance, and other. But I think those green bars demonstrate how big is big. This bounty has also given us at Minnesota Housing and the partners on whom we rely to deliver, it's given us a lot to do. Last year's housing bill doubles the number of programs that Minnesota Housing normally administers. So there is so much activity in so many areas across the spectrum of housing needs. So in the first column, this is just a quick list of existing programs where we already had processes in place. And so where the legislature put more money into existing programs, it's feeding right into existing processes. The second column are newly created programs that the legislature created last session, some of them with ongoing money and some of them with one-time money. So all of those require the creation of the infrastructure. The third column are legislatively named grantees. That is where a very particular organization was designated for certain line items. And that's just for context, really wanted you to understand that there were programs that we were already working on prior to last year's bill being signed that were a combination of previous state efforts as well as federal activities that we were engaged on. So I just wanted to kind of give you that context. You know, a part of what we had to do when session ended was to try to figure out whether we had the organizational structure in order to implement what you gave us. So we traditionally had two divisions that encompassed all of our programmatic work, our single-family homeownership division and our multifamily rental division. So my leadership team and I did a lot of work to determine how do we incorporate new programs with our existing staff, trying to understand how many additional staff we would need, and where we had systems in place that could accommodate new programs and where we needed to put new systems in place. So the first question I asked is, where does it fit in the org chart? And the second question was, do we need more staff? We took the multifamily division and we separated out from it the work that we do on housing stability. So that's a new division that has programs related to homelessness, homelessness prevention, and things like that. And I welcomed Renal Ray as the new Assistant Commissioner for Housing Stability into the organization. But we also got the green box, a bunch of things that really weren't single family or multifamily or housing stability, sometimes things that just didn't work in the same way as some of our other programs. So we have also created a local government housing programs team that is responsible for working with some of previous session items as well as 23 session items where our primary relationship is with a local government and less so with, for example, a nonprofit developer, a for-profit developer or something like that. So far, we've added over 20 new positions and continue to build out our teams. Next slide, please. What this slide tracks is really how are we doing committing the funds to actual projects. So if you take a look at these bars, the dark blue bar on the bottom represents where dollars have been committed. The green is stuff that's coming soon. And the light blue is stuff that's really more at the initial stages of being under development and is going to take a little bit longer. For things that are in that light blue space is where we really are going to have to do more work on the design with a lot of stakeholder input in order to put a process in place to support it. So if you take a look at the all resources bar, with open RFPs and anticipated contracts executions and named grantees, we expect that dark blue committed box to move up to about half or just over half of funding committed in the near future. So as you see in the second stack, money's going out the fastest where it is flowing through existing programs. And you know, that was something that we talked about quite a bit last session. So the existing programs, you have a higher percentage of dollars committed. In the new programs and the named grantees, we've got more work to do where we're building out new stuff. So it's about 60% committed in existing programs, about 37% as of today that's been committed or matched to programs as of right now. The existing programs where funding has been committed are listed out on this slide. And again, these are programs with the exception of the Stable Housing Organization Relief Program that I'll talk about in a moment. These are programs where the organization already had the programs, some of them longstanding, and the processes were in place. The ones that are in the coming soon category are ones where we have things that are either available now or we have a request for proposal process underway. So you can see that we'll have dollars matched to projects for public housing rehab, Greater Minnesota Workforce Housing Development, the rest of the Family Homeless Prevention Assistance. Also would just flag that the State Housing Tax Credit and Contribution Fund opened and closed last year for the first time and is open again so that folks can get information if they want to take advantage of that tax credit and either attach it to a specific development or to make an investment into the general fund, general pool for those dollars. And then in the next couple of months on the right, you'll see that we have other things that are soon to launch, either an RFP or a program, most notably the first generation down payment assistance programs, but I'll say more about that in a moment. There are a few things that I really wanted to highlight for you today. The first is the Family Homeless Prevention and Assistance Program. You may remember that you fast-tracked $50 million. And, you know, fast-track resources have helped over 6,400 households in 4 months. You know, compare that to historic levels of service, and you'll see the impact that that fast-track has had in helping either prevent homelessness or help people who have become homeless return to housing. And then of all the FHPAP Family Homeless Prevention dollars from session, we have an open RFP that closes on February 22nd to allocate the remaining funds that are there. You also did something that we hadn't worked with before, is that you allocated $10 million of the total for the tribes. And so I've been doing tribal consultations across the state. I've learned a great deal about allocations and the perspectives of the 11 tribes, and we're very close to have an agreement on tribal allocation. Even as the housing community was celebrating $1.3 billion for Minnesota Housing, we know that many housing organizations are experiencing significant challenges. The pandemic, inflation, supply chain, high interest rates, staff shortages, insurance costs, all at the same time. So we moved as fast as we could with the new Stable Housing Organization Relief Program that was a part of the total package last year. And by fast, I mean by government standards, really fast. We had that open to applications on September 1st of last year, and we had selections completed by October 26th. And we are working with 43 grantees that represent over 25,000 units, and those funds are flowing. So really appreciating the difficulty that some of our nonprofit housing partners are facing right now, we really prioritize doing that fast. We know there's much more that needs to be done in this space, but I want you to know that that was something that we really understood we needed to get done right away. Another program that I wanted to highlight is the work that we've done with first generation down payment assistance. $150 million in down payment assistance is going to be available this spring between both the community-based first-generation down payment assistance and the agency-based first-generation down payment assistance programs. We and many of our community partners are really working to help Minnesotans who have the opportunity to take advantage of this down payment assistance understand that now is the time to get ready, even before the funds are available, to really understand what you need to have in place in order to take advantage of this opportunity to buy a home. And we'll be doing that, building momentum with media coverage, social media, word of mouth, multiple ways in order to help people understand that this is a unique opportunity in the state. We've been working with Midwest Minnesota Community Development Corporation on the contract between us and them to run the community-based program. And my understanding is that today, actually, their application process for selecting community development financial institution partners, CDFIs, that their application is closed, so they'll be selecting the organizations that will make up the network of folks that are helping distribute the community first generation down payment assistance money. For the agency's piece, we've had a long-standing network of community lenders, and we're working with them to help them understand these different programs, how to figure out what is going to help a family assess what's best for them. I just can't reiterate enough for folks, if you know somebody who would qualify, it's never too soon to get ready. Because when the program launches, I think we don't have a sense of how quickly the money is going to be obligated. So to folks who are thinking about taking advantage, now is the time to get ready. The other piece I just wanted to highlight is this new local government housing programs team. This is a place where it was not like anything else. We didn't have other staff that were kind of in a position to do the work with local governments, cities, counties, housing authorities, housing redevelopment authorities. And so it's our great fortune that Jennifer Bergman has come on board in November. Jennifer was formerly the Brainerd City Administrator, but she's worked in a number of different local jurisdictions and housing authorities, and also just very glad for her. One, she's very well known and well regarded across the local government entities, but also just the experience that she brings having administered programs at a local level. And then it's always great to have another Jennifer, of course. But she is also filling out her team. So we'll have a local programs manager, and then we'll have a rental assistance manager that is working specifically with the new Bring It Home rental assistance program. We have a data analyst also who's on board now. We have program guides that are under creation, and for the things that require requests for proposals, you'll begin to see them roll out later on this year. In blue are the list of programs that will be under the local government housing programs team. The other highlight that I just wanted to show is the work that we're doing with manufactured home communities. When we opened up the request for proposal, we had more proposals than we had ever seen. And it was the largest ever selections for manufactured home community infrastructure that we did in December of last year. And this is the basic stuff. This is roads, sewer, water, storm shelters. This is about the quality of life for residents of manufactured home communities. So we funded $21.5 million supporting 19 different communities representing over 1,800 lots. We're also working with the North Country Cooperative Foundation to finalize the details of the $10 million manufactured home community acquisition fund that was created last session. As a part of our regular annual consolidated request for proposals processes for multifamily and single family housing, which is the largest production and preservation financing mechanisms that we have every year, We announced in December that we were doing $348 million of investment that would impact over 4,700 homes and create 7,000 jobs. Of that $348 million, $260 million of that was state resource from the 2023 legislative session, maybe a little bit that remained from previous years. So it's just exciting to be able to find out what we had in May and already by December to be able to match those dollars to projects. So to see that in a little bit more detail, first of all, the developers had heard the message that the legislature was going to go big. So we saw more applications in all three of those programs, manufactured housing, single family, and multifamily, than we've ever seen before. So the community was understanding that there was more, that there's more need out there, there was more that they were ready to do, and coming to us in funding. On homeownership, we did nearly $110 million, and that's about 1,300 homes. And guessing that it might come up, about 46% of the projects are in Greater Minnesota. On the rental side, it was about $150 million in state resources. So that includes the housing infrastructure, bond and cash, the challenge fund, and the PARIF, the preservation of affordable rental. And about 54% of the recommended projects are in Greater Minnesota. I think we all love maps. I love maps. What this shows are between the single family selections, the multifamily selections, and the manufactured home selections in green, blue, and I don't know what to call that, maroon, respectively, the dots on the map in terms of where those projects are located. I will reflect, though, as historic as the investments last year were, I still had to prioritize across the proposals and say yes to some, but not yet to others. So we weren't able to fund all the good proposals that came to us, even with these historic levels of investment. I personally would love to see this map just covered with dots. You are going to be spared a video clip because of technology, but what I was really wanting to show you is I get a chance to travel all over the state during session and actually see what these line items that you approve look like when they're in the ground and housing people, and had a chance recently to tour the construction of a new senior housing project up in Anoka County that's actually open today. And it's like, we can sit and talk about housing infrastructure bonds, but those are homes for modest income seniors in a community that hadn't done something like that for a while. So it's very exciting to actually see the dollars translate into real housing opportunities for people. So I want to pivot now to this session and the governor's recommendations. Minnesota Housing Partnership, the Realtors and Housing First are going to be talking more about housing needs, so I'm not going to take up my time with you to go over those because I know they'll do a very thorough job of that. The governor's proposal is for $50 million in housing infrastructure bonds and $7.5 million for public housing rehabilitation. While these numbers are modest compared to last year's investment, it is really crucial that we keep moving forward and keep investing in housing capital. The number of proposals that we couldn't fund last year is testament to the fact that there's community appetite, there's developer appetite, and certainly there's community need. This is simply a very quick refresher, and for new staff, a primer on housing infrastructure bonds. Why do we have them? It's largely because about 95% of the housing in the state of Minnesota isn't publicly owned. And so the geobond mechanism doesn't work for the capital needs of housing that isn't publicly owned. Since it was created in 2012, the housing infrastructure bonds and appropriations are the largest state source of capital for housing development. And it really has helped us address the lack of supply, especially for our lowest income households. Housing infrastructure bonds are unique to Minnesota and the envy of many of my peers across the country. The housing infrastructure supports a continuum of uses: the preservation of federally assisted rental housing, building and rehabilitation of permanent supportive housing that houses people with histories of homelessness. Again, as I just mentioned, the creation of affordable housing for seniors age 55 and older. Always makes me pause, 55 and older. A manufactured home community acquisition and infrastructure, developing single family homes, including in community land trusts, and the new construction of more deeply affordable rental housing and expanded use in 2023. So I think in sum, what the housing infrastructure investment since 2012, we've done $612 million committed, which has leveraged over $1.3 billion in total development costs, nearly 6,000 units created or preserved, including units that are in the pipeline now. This helps us reach low-income renters of color. It helps us reach households where there's a person with a disability. We've had newer expanded eligible uses. So we've done single family development with nearly $80 million committed, impacting over 1,300 homes. And we've been using it for manufactured home community acquisition and infrastructure, over $20 million committed, impacting over 1,700 lots. Just a really quick reminder on the public housing rehabilitation geo bonds. So we fund capital improvements in publicly owned public housing buildings, really prioritizing life safety and energy efficiency and fire suppression. We do elevator modernization, we do plumbing, we do windows, roofs, accessibility improvements, fire suppression again, just really basic things to take our public housing stock and make sure that it has a health and safety and quality of life for the residents who are there. Since 2012, we've done $63.5 million in 115 projects, preserving and improving over 8,500 units. Another map. Since 2012, showing where POP programs are, I always like to say that if you're in a smaller town in greater Minnesota, the tallest high-rise in that community is probably a publicly owned housing program, and oftentimes it's the most affordable unit in that community. And as you can see here, that about 64% of funds have gone to greater Minnesota, which represents about half of all the units. So in sum, we knew going into 2023 that we needed to go big so that all Minnesotans could go home, and you did. We're putting the investments to work. It's going fastest where it had existing programs and pipes, and we're working on creating the new programs, and we need to do more. Because the organizations that do the work need us. And the families and individuals who can't afford a stable place to live need us. And a healthy and productive future for Minnesota needs us. Thank you.
Thank you, Commissioner, and thank you to your team that's worked to implement. And thank you for what they're going to be continuing to work on to implement the rest. I'll just say it is really exciting to be talking about impact and real lives that will be benefited. More than 1,000 new homeowners, thousands of new affordable rental units. This is a big deal, and we're just getting started. Are there questions from members? Representative Kozlowski.
Thanks, Chair Howard, and Commissioner and team from Duluth.
We're very, very grateful for the work that we did together. Talk about first-time home housing supply to multifamily housing. I know that we quadrupled what we did with our community land trust, with our senior housing, affordable housing options, that's building in child care centers, and so much more. I think our community in the next 3 to 5 years is going to look wildly different thanks to what we did this past session. I was curious around the stable housing program that you mentioned, and there was just curious like what the spread was in terms of working with the nonprofits across the state. If you could give us a glimpse into, you know, where they're located and what types of nonprofits rose to the top, who you worked with. And then also curious around the housing infrastructure bonds. I came from the bonding committee earlier, and we discussed the governor's proposal. And, of course, we're crafting our own on the House side. And I think the governor's was 982. You know, we're looking at something like $830 million, and $50 million out of that pot is, what, 5%? And last year, I think we did about $100 million in HIB. And so just curious, like, why not more on those and what we can do to advocate. I would really like to see a higher threshold of those fundings. Thank you.
Commissioner.
Chair Howard, Representative Kozlowski, thank you. I had a fun opening some projects up in Duluth and breaking ground on some as well, and know the need is great there. Glad to do it. On the Stable Housing Organization Relief Program, we'd be happy to send around a list of the organizations that that qualified for that program. You will remember that it wasn't a competition per se, but there were a set of criteria, and any organization who qualified for the criteria was eligible for funding. And so after we determined who was eligible and the number of units that they had, we simply divided the amount available by the number of units, and that's what organizations were eligible for. Some of those organizations are large and statewide, so they cover communities all over the state. Some of them are smaller and very local, and so I think the best way to answer the question is just to get you a list of the organizations that qualified underneath that program. You know, I'm glad that we're advancing a bonding proposal and that housing is in it. I guess I'll say that the governor always is in the first position. So to be out there with $50 million for housing infrastructure bonds and $7.5 million for public housing preservation, I'm glad to be in the starting position. You know, I think that the governor, the lieutenant governor, the commissioner of Minnesota Management and Budget, the budget director, have had to curb the enthusiasm of 2023 as we head into 2024. In terms of just the availability of resources. But I'll also say that this is my sixth session, and neither the governor nor the lieutenant governor nor I have ever been offended when advocates have asked for a higher amount, nor have I resisted if we've ended up with a higher amount. I'm very glad to be in the starting position in the governor's budget.
Representative Norris.
Thanks, Chair Howard, and thank you, Commissioner Ho, and appreciate the work that your team and you have been doing to implement this bill over the past several months. I've got a couple of questions. Wanted to start with the manufactured housing space, which I've talked about before how important that is to my district. And you know, I think there were a lot of great things in last year's bill. It was probably the best bill perhaps in the state's history when it comes to manufactured housing. You highlighted the infrastructure grants that went out, and appreciate your work on that. You also mentioned the direct appropriation to North Country Cooperative Foundation. And that one I think is really important because I continue to hear concerns from manufactured housing residents about significant increases in rent. And we're looking at some things we can do around that, but one of the best ways we can address that is by allowing more of these parks to adopt a cooperative ownership model where the residents have self-determination. And I know that money hasn't gone out to NCF yet. I'm wondering if you could talk a little bit about, you know, either in that specific case, kind of what the holdup is, or, you know, more broadly, those that bar you showed with the name grantees, why so much of that is still kind of in the, you know, near committed stage at this point.
Commissioner Ho.
Chair Howard, Representative Norris, thank you for the question. We are in talks with them and are eager to get that out. In fact, I would just note that in addition to the appropriated dollars, the agency is also engaged in lending activities that supports the creation of manufactured home community cooperatives. And I think we've actually just recently helped finance one of those. I think that when the dust settled after session, I think that we had to have a lot of conversations about what does it mean to be a named grantee, but still be a grantee of the state, and therefore need to conform with the rules associated with grants management. And so there's a series of steps that we need to do with folks. My understanding, and I've met myself with the principals at North Country Cooperative Foundations, we're very close to having a contract wrapped up. So I'll be pleased to be able to report on that as the weeks of session tick by.
Great.
Representative Norris.
Thank you, Chair Howard. And thanks, Commissioner. With that particular direct appropriation, is the agency envisioning that that's going to be a lump sum of the full $10 million that was appropriated by the legislature in that bill, or would that be staggered?
Commissioner Ho.
Chair Howard, Representative Norris, and thanks for giving me a moment to get my muscles back here in this space as well. It's a great question. The Office of Grants Management default position is that grants are done on a reimbursement basis for an acquisition fund. That didn't make sense to us, but it also is incumbent on us, I think, to not just put it all out. Money doesn't have the same insured protection as it has when it's with the state. So we've been working with them to understand their pipeline of need. And so there will be an advance, and that's, I think, part of what the contract negotiations are now, understanding the cash flow expectation based on acquisitions that are in the queue. And then I think that the agency is in a position that as the first dollars that have been dispersed are obligated by them, that we'll be in a position to do a next disbursement. So I'd say I would characterize it as being not reimbursement-based, which would be the default position, because that doesn't make any sense. Not a lump sum, but a series of tranches based on projects in the queue. And we'll work very closely with them to make sure that we're not an obstacle to the timely acquisition and conversion to a cooperative.
Great. Chair Howard, Commissioner Ho, thank you for that explanation, and appreciate your, you know, trying to be flexible on that. And, you know, obviously we want to safeguard state funds, but there's also kind of a unique way that these funds will be used to facilitate those purchases. You know, so I'll just offer, you know, to the extent that, you know, there's any additional work we need to do on the legislative side to help make that work best for everybody, you know, I stand ready, you know, until we adjourn here in a couple of months to try to work with everybody to make sure we can accomplish that intended goal. And then if there's time for one more quick question, Chair Howard. This is shifting gears now. You know, I mentioned the manufactured housing in my community. I also am fortunate to have a very large Muslim community in Blaine and Lexington, and I met with some of their leaders recently, and the topic of interest-free home financing came up, obviously, you know, something that's very top of mind for that community. I'm wondering if you have any updates on, you know, some of the things that the agency is doing to help facilitate that, or any recommendations for what we should be looking at here on the legislative side to help those communities.
Commissioner Ho.
Chair Howard and Representative Norris. So for folks who are following along, that's the fee-based home purchasing program for NeighborWorks Home Partners. We are in discussions with them. My understanding is that they are potentially seeking a legislative change because there was some language in the final bill last year that they don't want us to codify in contract. And so we are in discussions, and we will work to be waiting to see whether or not those changes are in. And Dan tells me that it's in the agency's policy bill to help facilitate them getting the changes that they require.
Thank you.
Lee Johnson.
Chair Howard, Commissioner Hull. I got a few questions. Hopefully you can answer them. First of all, what is the actual dollar amount that's been dispensed this time of the almost $1.4 billion? Do you have a rough idea or a percentage?
Commissioner Ho.
Chair Howard and Representative Johnson, I know it's roughly 37%, and I don't have my calculator in front of me, but roughly 37% of $1.3 billion would be the answer.
Lee Johnson.
Chair Howard, Commissioner Hull, and of that 37%, how much, what percentage of that has gone to nonprofits?
Commissioner Ho.
Chair Howard, Lee Johnson, I am not in a position to answer that question today, but we certainly could go back to see. We rely on nonprofits for a lot of our work on family homeless prevention. We work with both for-profit and nonprofit developers in the single-family and multifamily space. We always have. So I suspect that it's considerable, but I don't have those dollars at my fingertips.
Lee Johnson.
Chair Howard, Commissioner, the reason I ask is last year we had the OLA report dealing with grants to nonprofits, and there's a severe lack of oversight on how the funds were done. I'm just wondering, have you put in place any new protocols for oversight to make sure that the funds are being used properly?
Commissioner Ho.
Chair Howard and Lee Johnson, first of all, yes, we have centralized a lot of our procurement and grants management activities, actually even prior to the end of the 2023 legislative session, I think in anticipation of the fact of a higher volume. I don't know specifically which OLA report you're referencing. I don't know that the OLA had found problems with our grants management overall. I think there were a couple of improvements that they suggested that we did implement in terms of being in full conformance. But the agency has worked with nonprofits for decades, in large part because for-profits don't want to do some of what we do and local government can't do some of what we want to do. And so it's been in statute that we work with nonprofits for many of the programs that we operate.
Lee Johnson.
Chair Howard, Commissioner Hull, thank you for at least following that. I didn't say it was nonprofits you had, but it was nonprofits in general across the spectrum. I don't believe that the ones you deal with were looked at, but if there's a problem someplace, it's time to look at things, make sure things are being done properly with the state tax dollars that came out of the pockets of the citizens of Minnesota. You said you had mentioned that you've had to, because of the increase in the budget, you've had to hire a few more staff. Sounds like even a new commissioner, a new director. So approximately how many new FTEs had, because of this large increase, have you had to hire to fulfill the obligations of the legislation passed last year?
Commissioner Ho.
Chair Howard and Lee Johnson, as of last week, we had added about 24 staff. As a point of reference, that was on top of an FTE count of about 275 that we started with. I am not in a position yet to say what the total number of FTEs that we'll need, because we're really hiring for the front end of new funding programs, and there's a whole back end compliance element that we also are funding to. So we haven't assessed a final number of total FTEs that are required for the program.
Lee Johnson.
Chair Howard, Commissioner Oso, it's about a 10% increase in your staff so far, or 8 to 10%, and you're probably going to be over that, I have a feeling. I think it's I think that's you've been doing well trying to keep it down. I appreciate that, because it was about almost 300% increase in your budget last year. So I appreciate trying to keep those numbers down the best you can. And I appreciate the work you're doing. You had mentioned something about the working on the homeless program where you help. I got to find my number on here again. About 6,400 households. The one-day snapshot last January, or a year ago January, there was about 8,300 that night that were homeless. So of these 6,400 households, do you have an approximate number of individuals that were helped with this program?
Commissioner Ho.
Chair Howard and Lee Johnson, I can get that information for you, but I don't have that with me today.
Okay, thank you.
I have Representative Dotseth and Representative Igbaja on the list, and I'm hoping we can do it short so we can get to the rest of our presentations, but I think it's important, and I appreciate the Commissioner taking some time to answer some questions. So I'll go to Representative Dotseth.
My pleasure. Thank you, Chair Howard, Commissioner Ho. I'm going to kind of piggyback on a question that Representative Johnson had asked, but with that $1.3 billion, the 37% that was actually spent already distributed out, do we actually have a breakdown of administrative costs? I know he had mentioned nonprofit, but just overall administrative costs versus how much actually went to the end user at the end.
Commissioner Ho.
Chair Howard, Representative, I'm just taking a moment because I'm just trying to figure out if that is something that I could calculate for you, because each of these line items works very differently. And I think that you're asking about not only the agency's cost of operation, but you're also talking about the recipient's cost of operation. Is that correct?
That'd be correct.
I will need to go back and consult with our finance team to understand if I can get an approximation for you. Every line item is different, and the way the money flows and the way that we track it is different, but let me see what I can do. I appreciate the question.
In conclusion, I'll just state, I'd like to see more focus on just really looking at the root cause, what's creating the homelessness and the challenges with the housing. Is it jobs, lack of jobs? Is it inflation? What's actually causing the housing crisis?
Thanks, Representative. And I'll go to Vice Chair Igbaje. Oh, Representative Hassan, if you can go. Yep.
Sorry, Mr. Chair. I had to go and present a bill in another committee, and maybe this question has been asked, and if it did, I'm sorry, Commissioner. The home ownership, that's the only question I ask always. The home ownership funding that we passed last year, can you just elaborate on what has went out and where's the process on that?
Commissioner.
Chair Howard, and you'll see it in the slide deck. When you have a chance to take a look at the slides. I think I just want to make sure we're talking about the first generation down payment assistance. Is that correct?
Representative Ho, or Representative Hassan.
No, I'm talking about home ownership in general. We funded different programs that are home ownership. So,
Commissioner Ho.
Chair Howard, Representative Hassan. So there are a number of programs where funding has been matched to programs. The largest home ownership ones were ones that were selected in our annual consolidated RFP. And we can get you a list of the single family selections from that RFP from December. That incorporates where we had existing programs in place that help support both the creation and preservation, acquisition, rehab, community land trusts, many different activities as it relates to single family home ownership. We have a number of other new programs that relate to home ownership, and they're at various stages of progress. So I think I would need to sit with you, which I'm happy to do, and just go over them line by line to give you a progress report on where they're at.
Representative Hussein, if you can be quick.
Yeah, I'll be quick.
Thank you.
Thank you, Commissioner. This question has been asked, and it's the fee-based down payment assistance for the $10 million. And that is the one that we've been getting a lot of emails. We want to make sure that we haven't heard from you or from your office that there was an error. Would you mind explaining what error are you running to? And is this bill, is this money will be available the same time that is the first down payment assistance for spring?
And Representative Hussein, I think I might just take part of that question. I don't know if it's fair to say there was an error. I don't think it's fair to say that there was an error, but there's a clarification that's been requested to make sure that this program is expansive and available, and that's what we're working on, and to make sure that it's available statewide. Can I go to Representative Igbaje?
Thank you, Commissioner Ho. I just wanted to on the first generation down payment assistance program. I know that you guys are working both with the community-based program and also the agency program. And just kind of, if you can just give like a brief update on kind of when the money is expected to go out, and then also kind of some questions that have come up are about any language barriers issues that may come up around the state, and just kind of how you guys are planning for those, especially for those communities that don't always necessarily come either directly to the agency and may want to know about that program too.
Commissioner Ho.
Chair Howard, Representative Mabuse, I'm very appreciative of the question. The contract with Midwest Minnesota CDC, we are in negotiations right now and likely to have the contract wrapped up in March, April. And I'm sure that it will launch by them very soon after that contract is executed. As I mentioned, they themselves are just closing on an application for who their sub-lenders are going to be. So they're going to have to put subcontracts into place with their sub-lenders. So that's a part of the timeline that they'll need to manage with their partners and community on that. But I expect that it'll be going out pretty quickly. I know that the Home Buying Partnership Center and Midwest Minnesota Community Development Corporation have already begun to do some messaging out into communities around the same get ready message. At Minnesota Housing, we are also working on a marketing RFP to make sure that we have organizations that have reach into communities where there are first generation home buying potential. But people who may not be familiar with Minnesota Housing may not have English as their first language. We want to make sure that we're reaching people in their communities from trusted sources of information in those communities and available to people in the language that they read and speak. So we're working on that now. And I think the two efforts are mutually reinforcing because the message is the same. It's really at the moment that you're working with your CDFI or you're working with your mortgage lender or you're working with your housing counselor that you'll do the assessment of which program is right for you. And so we see these as very complementary efforts in terms of the reach, but absolutely, I think the organization understands that this is a targeted effort for first generation home buyers, and that means that it's important for us to reach the communities where they live.
Vice Chair.
Thank you, Chair, and thank you, Commissioner Ho. I'm really looking forward to it and continue to keep up conversations with both MMCDC and Minnesota Housing. My last question is really on the programs around public housing. Just thank you for that update in there, and then just wanting to know, are there kind of what types of homes are being affected by the money that's gone out towards rehabilitation for public housing, and then also how else can we be supportive of public housing efforts that you guys need?
Commissioner Ho.
Chair Howard, Representative Abajay, the public housing preservation is something that we've done for quite a few years, and so it really is up to the public housing authority or the housing and redevelopment authority that owns it to propose the project. Since we work with public housing authorities large and small, I think one of the things we've tried to do over the course of the last few years is have what we call kind of a simple and conceptual application process. So the smaller, greater Minnesota organizations that might only have one or two staff and one or two buildings aren't put off by a process that was written for a St. Paul or a Minneapolis public housing authority. But we work in both, and with more money available, you know, we think that we'll be able to also support larger rehab projects. But again, oftentimes it's been critical health and safety features, fire suppression, a new boiler. But there's also an opportunity to do energy efficiency, which also improves indoor air quality for residents, which helps folks mitigate against asthma attacks and things like that. So I think one of the things I'm really excited about as we're have an RFP out right now for the first part of the investments that you've made in this last year is we didn't want to put it all out at once. One, because we thought some organizations were going to have to get their head around the fact that we got so much money and that therefore the scope of what they could propose would be bigger. So we want a chance to do that. We also have to rewrite the program guide because you gave some of it to us in cash so we can decouple it from the structure of the general obligation bonds, but we actually see some pretty broad application in terms of what it can do in public housing authorities, large and small.
Thank you, Commissioner, for your time, and we'll be seeing plenty of you in the weeks and months ahead.
I look forward to each opportunity to be in front of the committee chair. Thank you so much for your time.
Next, we have a presentation on the housing landscape here in Minnesota by Ann Mavity, the Executive Director of the Minnesota Housing Partnership. And it's the first committee hearing of the year, but we're already running a little long, so might ask you to be around 15 minutes so we can get through a lot of good information that we need to hear.
Hi there. My name is Ann Mavity, and I am the Executive Director of the Minnesota Housing Partnership, and hopefully we'll get this up in a minute, but why don't I just get started, so because I know we're compressed on time.
Thank you, and members, we do have the presentation in our packet also.
Fantastic. Oh, and here it is. No. So which one am I using that mouse? Okay. Put that bugger up. Minnesota Housing Partnership, many of you know, I've been before this committee again, and I very much appreciate Chair Howard and others the opportunity to come here today again. We are a nonprofit. We work statewide, and we work to advance equitable housing policy. We help produce data-driven research that helps drive data-driven solutions, and we also provide technical assistance to rural communities and tribal entities that may be too small to have their own housing expertise on staff, and we help lend that to them. So today, I wanted to talk about sort of the walk you out of the halls of the agency, appreciate the information that we just received, and bring you down to Main Street to where your constituents are talking with you about housing. And you're going to help me out here one more time. And to talk about what's happening actually on the street. So Minnesota Housing produces a state of the state's housing report. There it goes. Every 2 years, and that we provide data, key trends to look at what does this feel like on the ground in terms of what people are actually experiencing in the housing market today. So we know that Minnesotans are struggling right now to find a place to live, to make the rent, to make the mortgage. And the headlines of all of this, we could just drop the mic right now and walk out. I've mentioned this before. We need more housing of every single type in every single corner of this state. We are short units across housing types, across income types. And so that is our challenge. And the good news is we know that there are effective solutions to help solve for this. And the investments that you all made last year, led by this committee and taken on with your colleagues in the House and the Senate and the governor's office as well, has helped drive some of those solutions. And as we've heard, it's going to take a minute to see all those investments come to fruition. But we have effective solutions to do that. I'm not going to spend time on this, but I just want to remind us, why are we in this mess? We're short on housing because of the recession way back in 2006, 2007, 2008. We underproduced. We are trying to overproduce. We're at the top of that line right there on the catch-up phrase, but we're not caught up yet, and there's more work to be done. I'll also note, as we're trying to produce new housing, we need to be paying attention to preserving the housing that we have. We just heard that the agency was funded the creation of 4,720 new homes, which is fantastic, and that's what we need to see. We also know that we are losing thousands of existing homes, and we're losing their affordabilities to inflation and rising costs and all these other pressures, including some of the pressures that our nonprofit housing providers are experiencing. And so we need to preserve the homes we have, even as we produce new ones. So we have these historic investments that came down last year. Thank you very much for all of that work. What we also have are these pressures on the other side. And so what we know and what we're recognizing is that these pressures mean that the funding that we got is not going as far as we hoped, because the costs are rising per unit cost to create the housing. It's costing more money to preserve the housing that we have. And there's other limitations. I see, Representative Johnson was talking about the squeeze in the starter homes. And part of that is these rising costs. And we're going to talk about that and illustrate that with new data as well. So let's talk about some of this new data that's coming through. So first point, housing is unaffordable right now to half of all Minnesota renters. So we talk about being cost burdened is when you're paying more than 30% of your income for housing. 2 years ago, our data, and we reported to this committee, that 44% of Minnesota renters were paying more than they could afford for housing. That trend is going the wrong direction, and this year we're reporting that it's more than half. So, yeah, so that's troubling, and again, it's why you're hearing from constituents or feeling yourself that squeeze in the marketplace. It's not that someone's individually doing anything wrong. It's these market pressures on externally that are causing that affordability to squeeze and tighten and make people pay too much for their homes. So rents are climbing. So what we also know is that the median rent increased by 8% in just 1 year, and that is the largest per year increase in rent that we have in rental costs that we have seen in the past decade. So again, that squeeze that people are feeling is being backed up by this data. And so while renter incomes have increased by 3% over 5 years, the rent has increased more than that, 7%. And again, that's what people are feeling, and the fact that these trends are happening year over year over year and not changing is why those pain points are being felt in the market and from your constituents. The cost of owning a home is outpacing incomes of Minnesotans. So when we talk about owner households, owner home ownership, the income for homeowners has gone up 2% over the last 5 years, but dramatically, the cost of homes, a median price home, has gone up 19% over that same time period. So that gap, again, to Representative Johnson's point, that is why these starter home, there's fewer starter homes available, there's fewer ones within reach, the competition among those homes is much more dramatic because that trend is just widening between incomes and costs. The other thing that we're seeing in terms of the key trends that our State of the State's housing report has identified is that eviction filings are once again increasing, 44% relative to the pre-COVID average, not even holding steady for what was happening during the pandemic. And so, and the year-over-year increase was 8% in evictions. And what we know is, just like it's more cost-effective to preserve the homes we have, it's more cost-effective to keep people housed. One eviction can create decades of housing instability, increased costs both financially but also dramatically in terms of the strength of the community and families that we're trying to support. So going back to cost burdens, one of the things that we see on the cost burdens that are particularly troubling is that the impacts of being cost burdened are felt disproportionately across the most vulnerable communities and neighbors that we have. So for example, seniors, two-thirds of our senior renters are paying more than they can afford for housing. And we know that these costs and those cost pressures, whether it's healthcare and medications and prescriptions or other kinds of costs, when you're paying too much for housing, and especially among our seniors, everything suffers in your life. And the same thing is with our lowest income renters can be paying, 80% of them can be paying too much. I will note that the disparities, the racial disparities in this persist. So we are seeing, 46% of white householders that are cost burdened versus 57% in black householders. And of course, you all helped create these strategic and intentional strategies to try to address what is the second worst racial gap in home ownership across the country. What we're seeing is it's going to take a while to have that actually have an impact and show up in the data. We're not seeing it. And in fact, black home ownership rates are down from the previous year, 29% this year versus 31% previously. Same with Native home ownership rates are down 44% today versus 50% in the last year. Hispanic home ownership rate is down 49% this year versus 57%. These trends are all going in the wrong direction. White home ownership rates are staying relatively flat. They're down 1%, but relatively flat. So we know that a strong Minnesota means that we take care of our children, we take care of our neighbors. What we're seeing right now in terms of our children, that more children today are living in households that cannot afford rent or mortgage. So we have 2,000 more households this year than we had last year with children that cannot afford their rent or their home. 2,000 more than last year, and that number is 281,000 households across Minnesota with children that are struggling. So we know that we have great solutions, and you all helped fund many of those in this past year. And we know that there's market and these external pressures that people are feeling on the streets that are making that harder. The last data point, I think it's the last data point I wanted to lift up, is we track from Deed the top in-demand jobs that are being created. So I talk about the folks like the home and healthcare aides, the folks that are taking care of my mom right now. They might be taking care of your kids. They might have served you coffee this morning. All these service jobs, the most in demand in Minnesota that we're trying to fill, do not make enough money to pay the rent on a typical two-bedroom apartment, a full-time worker. And for the first time in 10 years since we've been tracking this, even a nurse, a registered nurse, it no longer makes enough money to afford average, a median home in Minnesota. So that is the first time, and that's a little troubling to see that trend come down, because before we'd always say, well, nurses, teachers, firefighters, you know, we could maybe push and make sure that they can actually get into home ownership. And this is where we're not seeing that this year in terms of the trend. So we know that when everyone, including the people who work in everyday regular jobs, when they can afford to live near where they work, our communities are not only better, they're also stronger. So so we have solutions that we've shared with you, and you all have solutions that we're working together on. And what I wanted to do is just highlight just a couple of these. We know that one of the things, I know you don't have budget targets yet, but emergency rental assistance would be one of the top areas that we would offer for your consideration to be targeting funding. Once again, keeping people stably housed is one of the critical strategies. And we have an effective deployment system in our state to actually get that money to the people who need it most. You're also going to hear a lot about why these starter homes are so unaffordable these days. And so we know that there needs to be strategies to reduce those barriers to affordability and creating new homes. Time is money, especially when it comes to housing and housing development. So looking at land use reforms that I think some of our speakers following me will talk about and that we're working on, we think can help facilitate both the speed and reduce the costs of what it takes to create new homes as well. So what you did last year was amazing, and we believe that that is exactly the level of priority and investment that needs to happen year over year over year, because it is an investment. It is foundational to strong communities, to our families, like the air we breathe, the food we eat, every single person. It's a basic human need to put your head somewhere at night. And so the investments you guys are making in this committee will have benefits for generations to come. So happy to talk more about, answer any questions if you have any as well.
Thank you, Ms. Mavity, and thank you for condensing so much information. I would suggest, members, that you take this presentation and keep this in the save folder, because the data here and the what's impacting hundreds of thousands of Minnesotans, this really should be the focus of our work this session and beyond to move this needle in the right direction. You had a question, Lee Johnson?
Sure, Howard, just a little bit of a comment. For the testifier, they talked about the rent issue with the 8% increase in rent. Historically, if you go back through the decades, whenever we have high inflation, rent is the number one hit on that. It goes up the highest. We've had, if they actually use the same numbers as back in the 70s, the inflation rate that we hit this past couple of years is actually higher than in the 70s. So it's probably the highest inflation rate we've ever had if they use the same numbers.
Thank you, and thank you, Ms. Mavity. Mm-hmm. Next, we have a presentation from Mark Foster with Housing First and Paul Egger from the Minnesota Realtors with some more background on the state of housing here in Minnesota. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just bear with me 1 second, please.
And if we're having a technology challenge, members do have the packet here, and we're running. Okay.
There we go.
Okay.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, for the invitation today, and hope my voice holds out. So apologies if it doesn't, but thank you again for the invitation to be here. My name is Paul Egger, Senior Vice President of Governmental Affairs for the Minnesota Realtors Association. I'll give you the abbreviated who we are because we, I think, know each other by now, but we are a statewide business trade association that was formed in 1919, so we have a long history in the state. We have over 22,000 members working in all aspects of real estate in every corner of the state. I'm going to jump right into it. You've heard a lot of good information today, Mr. Chair, and we hope we're additive to that exercise today. But just want to start out by sharing with you a few of the key challenges that I think you've already heard a bit about today and that, that we see in the housing market as it exists. One is the lack of supply. You've heard that from other speakers today. Mr. Chair, you started out the committee by kind of orienting the committee to that effort that you're going to lead this session. But Minnesota needs more housing units. And not surprisingly, when you don't have enough supply to meet demand, affordability is going to be a problem, and so we're also seeing pressure on housing affordability across the board. Interest rates are also certainly not helpful at the moment. I have a couple of slides that just kind of show you where rates are now and where they've been and what that means for the market if and when we see rates start to fall back down a little bit in the coming months. And finally, as mentioned by previous speakers, and you spent a lot of time on this effort last session, again, I want to thank you for passing the First Generation Home Buyers Down Payment Assistance Fund, but the racial home ownership gap is going to be a continuing challenge that we look forward to working with you all on in the coming years. So when we talk about lack of supply, we really do have two main metrics that we track, and one is month supply of inventory, so that's the inventory of homes for sale at the end of a given month divided by the average monthly pending sales for 12 months. And then we have just the aggregate number of properties for sale at the end of a given month. And I've talked about this in the past, but just keep in mind, a healthy market is one that's characterized by between 4 and 6 months supply of inventory. So if you look where we're at right now, we are at a significant deficit. We last hit 4 months supply, so the very low end of a healthy market, back in July of 2016. And the median sales price, not surprisingly, has risen as a result of there not being enough supply to meet that demand. So home prices are rising. We see the median sales price has more than doubled since 2012 and is now at $335,000 at the end of 2023. Again, markets are doing what you would expect markets to do. Low supply and high demand equals rising home prices. We also see closed sales in 2023 fell to their lowest level since 2010, just over 65,000 closed sales in that. The graphic on your slide doesn't go back that far, but that number was 65,000 roughly in 2010. And again, that combination of lack of supply, rising home prices, and higher interest rates are really, really presenting a big challenge. And to the supply issue, excuse me, again, we saw new listings at their lowest level since 2012, so over 11 years. If you look back on the slide, 107,500 listings in 2012. We saw 85 listings for homes in 2023. So you have that insufficient housing stock, and then obviously some sellers, we hear about the lock-in effect, where if you have a low interest rate before rates started to rise, that there's a disincentive to putting your home on the market. Certainly that's at play as well. And just a little bit on interest rates. So if you look at the graphic, interest rates were up dramatically in 2023 compared to where they were, say, in the certainly 2020, 2021, and 2019. So rates have certainly dampened the market activity. But despite the high rates, home prices continue to rise. And that really is another indicator that our demand far outweighs our supply, even as rates are causing monthly mortgage payments to increase significantly. So the question is that people often have is, well, if rates stabilize, will our home prices come down? And, you know, typically when interest rates rise, home prices fall. But when you have an imbalance in supply, you're going to see when rates fall, we expect that there will be more buyers that jump into the market because now they can find housing that is more affordable than they could under, say, 6.8% interest rates. And you're also going to see sellers jump in. So you're going to see kind of a tandem entry into the market. And when you don't have enough supply already, it's likely going to end up in a little bit of a canceling effect. So it's not going to have as dramatic as impact as we would hope. The next slide I'm going to show after this one is our housing affordability index. I just want to provide a little bit of context for that before I put the graphic up. And so when you see this slide, keep in mind a value of 100 means that a family with the median income has exactly enough income to qualify for a mortgage based on a median priced home. So 100 means 100%. 100 means median income, qualify for a median priced home. And one caveat here to keep in mind, there's an assumption built in here of a down payment of 20%. And we know that many first-time buyers in particular are not coming to the table with anywhere near that. So just keep that in mind a little bit on this data point. So value below 100 indicates that a family earning the median area income does not have enough income to qualify for a mortgage on a median-priced home. Then here's the graphic, and you can see in 2023, 97, below 100. So this is a really challenging time for affordability, and it's hard to qualify for a mortgage based on kind of where prices are at the current time with commodity interest rates. So, Mr. Chair, I move quickly. I know you're pressed for time, but just a few takeaways. You know, Minnesota's inventory shortage is going to continue to create affordability challenges, particularly for first-time buyers. And then again, even if mortgage rates come down, we expect demand to rise and home prices to stay elevated. And finally, back to the solutions moving forward, we look forward to working with you because we need to remove the barriers and make it harder to build homes in this state and at all price points so that we have enough homes to satisfy the demand. Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I'll turn it over to Mark for the next portion of the presentation.
Thank you, and we'll go about 5 minutes long today, members.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Good afternoon, Chair Howard and committee members. My name is Mark Foster, and I am the Vice President of Legislative Affairs for Housing First Minnesota. We are a trade association of nearly 1,000 members of the home building industry that have one goal in mind, advancing home ownership opportunities for all Minnesotans. Thank you for the opportunity to spend a few months, or months, running short on time, minutes with you this afternoon to discuss those home ownership opportunities and how the home building industry is working to meet the needs of Minnesotans. Looking into the new year, our concerns about the future of home ownership in Minnesota continue to grow. As you briefly heard from prior testifiers, our housing market is chronically undersupplied, but the demand to own a house remains intense. Unfortunately, on the regular, home buyers are getting priced out, especially younger buyers. In part, this is causing the national median age of a first-time buyer to hit 35 years old, nearly an all-time high. As it sits today, Minnesota's housing market is far from healthy. So how did we get here? Ever since the Great Housing Depression of 2007 to 2009, we simply haven't built enough homes. As this chart shows, the decade from 2010 to 2019 was far and away the decade with the least amount of housing activity that we've seen over the past 60 years. At the same time, our population and household formation continued to grow as a state and region. Today, statewide, we are over 100,000 units short of a healthy housing market. And like Ann mentioned previously, this includes everything: condos, apartments, townhomes, single-family homes. If you're a yellow state on this map, you've got a big problem, and we're a yellow state. Unfortunately, here in Minnesota, our numbers, by many standards, are alarmingly some of the worst in the nation. This chart is based off the starting point recommended by Governor Dayton's Housing Task Force back in 2018, 300,000 homes by 2030 in order to have a more even supply to demand. In 2021, we actually started to make a slight dent into the deficit. Unfortunately, we lost a lot of that progress the past couple of years in large part to rising interest rates, and now our deficit is larger than when we started in 2018. And the homes that we do build are unattainable for too many. The median new single-family detached has now gone north of $530,000 in the state. And this map shows the median price of a new home in Minnesota compared to all of our surrounding neighbors. As you can see, the median new price in Minnesota is nearly $100,000 more than all of our competitors, or about 20% up to upwards of 30%. Housing is very much an economic competitiveness issue, and Minnesota is losing. Just as recently as 2020, nearly 50% of MSP households could afford a new home, with a rolling 20-year average at about 45%. Today, less than 30% of households can afford to buy a new house. In this chart, you want as much red and gray as possible, as those are homes built either under $300,000 or in the $300,000 to $450,000. As you can see, we're losing to our Midwest peers by quite a bit. Chicago, Milwaukee, Nashville, we like to compare those. We think those are pretty equal comparisons to MSP. Similarly, in this chart, you want to be as far to the left as possible, as it shows market share under 300,000. Minneapolis ranks with the likes of cities more on the coast. Of course, there are many factors that contribute to the cost of a new home: land, building materials, labor, and regulatory requirements. Our members work through these dynamics every day in order to bring more housing online, but it isn't easy and continues to get more difficult. Despite that, we are attempting to meet consumers where they are. In many instances, they continue to call for greater density, smaller homes on smaller lots, less demand for garage space. While not all consumers are asking for these items, there's a growing segment of first-time buyers, single people, and downsizers that are. And of course, with the new work-from-home model, space for an office is a new must-have. We know that the housing supply issue will not solve itself. Homes simply do not just appear. And we remain committed for the long term. This is a topic that has gained intense coverage in the past few years, all over the country. This slide has something for everyone in this room. Three Republican governors, three Democrat governors, all with a very similar message: remove exclusionary roadblocks to allow for the creation of more housing supply. Finally, We are dedicated to continuing to build the safest, most durable, and energy-efficient homes in the country. We will always protect the environment. The industry is proud to pay good wages. All these are guiding principles for our members. As I mentioned earlier, we are committed to providing consumers with more choice. There's a massive market for starter homes, modest homes with functional space on small lots. Homeowners know how large they want their garage to be. Homeowners know how many trees they want in their yard. Homeowners know whether or not they need upgraded stone exteriors on their homes. As I continue to talk, I want to briefly show you examples of starter homes, primarily from other parts of the country. There was a time post-World War II when a small home on a small lot was the centerpiece of the American dream. Back then, we couldn't build them fast enough. There are many examples of these neighborhoods in parts of St. Paul, Minneapolis, and the surrounding first-ring suburbs. These homes are someone's dream homes. And as we built, we saw families grow and flourish, generational wealth created, and communities strengthened. Home ownership in a safe, durable home was the goal then. Unfortunately, we've lost our way on that simple foundational premise. In 2024, we find ourselves again in this position, recommitting to building starter homes so that communities can flourish and meet the demand for housing. This house on the far left is actually a house in St. Louis Park. We were allowed to build them at one point in time. A prime example of these homes built on a smaller lot is this home in North St. Paul. This was built by the Housing First Minnesota Foundation with our build partners, Lennar and MACV, as part of our work to end homelessness in Minnesota. Built in 2020, this building now serves as a transitional home for homeless veterans. This house is illegal to build in most growing cities. Since 2017, we've worked with our build partners to complete 11 Housing for Heroes homes and are currently building four more. Additionally, during that time, we have worked with Avivo and other build partners to renovate 15 apartments. This work is truly having an impact for hundreds of Minnesotans. And this is just more data on what our foundation is doing year after year. In conclusion, Minnesota's housing market is dramatically undersupplied. We are losing to our neighbors on a number of fronts. For the sake of the next generation of homebuyers, we need to remove the exclusionary roadblocks, and we need your help doing it this session. Thank you for the opportunity to address the committee, and we look forward to working with you all this session to address our housing supply and affordability issues, and as Mr. Chair has said, legalize more housing options.
Thank you, Mr. Foster. I want to reiterate something that you said that I thought was really poignant for us, which is that this housing crisis is not a problem that's going to solve itself. We cannot be passive observers to what's happening in our housing ecosystem and expect things are going to get better. If we do that, it's actually going to get quite a bit worse. It just speaks to the fact that we've got a lot of work to do this session. And we're going to start right next week on some of that work. We've heard a lot about some of the challenges. Next week, we get to work on solutions. And so thank you for the commissioner and those that testified and to members. We'll see you next week. This meeting is adjourned.